Hello and welcome back to today's episode about political communication when there is a crisis. Last week, we talked about the multiple crisis era and we decided to delve into crisis communication. And this week, it's us again. For those of you who haven't been loyal enough to ourselves, it's still the same people. Me, Jesper, today's expert on how politicians communicate in crisis, and who else is in this room right now?
Alejandra, and I'm going to be talking about NGOs and international organizations.
And me, Cecilia, I'm going to talk about the news agencies and medias.
Yeah, and I think this is enough to start right off. Ceci, would you like to give us some insight into crisis communication as a general concept?
Yeah. Thank you for handing it over. Yes, I think it's good before we start diving into our topic to overall talk about the definition of crisis communication, to maybe first define what is a crisis? How does it get defined? So basically what one could say is that a crisis normally disrupts normal operations wherever it is happening. So it somehow carries this sense of urgency, but at the same time also uncertainty. And crisis communication is now the communication to address these issues, these crises. So it's often a strategic effort that is provided in a time frame, but also in a clear and accurate way, providing information to most often manage the situation and the big goal to mitigate the harm. And it's very important to have good crisis communication in terms of crisis because it can actually help you a lot in tackling it. So it can very much influence public opinion. It can also help in shaping policy and action. Media coverage is proven to have a big influence on the public sentiment, especially during crises, because it can often help guide political decisions, but it can also influence funding of international aid responses, for example. But the most obvious thing is, of course, it can help build trust and reduce fear, because if you have a clear and transparent communication, that mitigates a lot of harm. Of course, there are also challenges crisis communication can face, uncertainty itself of the crisis, but also ethical dilemmas, what the different actors should focus on. And then, of course, there is the audience it is most often targeting, which can be very polarized or have different emotions depending on what crisis it is. So there are most often different actors in crisis communication, which we're going to focus on now. We already said that everybody has a different group. There are the governments and politicians. There is the NGOs or the humanitarian organizations. There are media newspapers. But there also are private companies or other actors. However, we're not going to focus on them in this episode right now. One thing I just wanted to mention, because when I Googled crisis communication, the first thing that popped up were the 5 C's of crisis communication, which I found very interesting. Have you ever heard of these 5 C's?
I have not.
No.
No, yeah. I think they're mainly used for private companies to address crisis they face internally. I will tell you more about it with the example of an NGO. I think that fits very well. So the first C is concern, which basically means for the NGO, for example, to show empathy for those who are affected. And then the second one is commitment, to maybe pledge to the ones in power to address the issue and commit yourself to facing it. Then number 3 is the competency. So you really should demonstrate that you have expertise in managing the crisis, or you know what is happening and can maybe be helpful. Then number 4 is the clarity, which basically means sharing clear and accessible information for everybody. And number 5 is the confidence. So building trust through transparency, reliability, and just having a confident appearance. But maybe you, Jesper, can give us more about the context, what was happening in 2015 before we dive into our topics.
Yeah, since just talking about crisis communication would be... not to offend you, Ceci, too dry to just talk about theoretically. We will talk about it in the context of the so-called refugee crisis in Europe in 2015 and 2016, which was triggered by ongoing wars and violence, civil wars, especially the rise of ISIS in Syria and Iraq, and that then led to this, influx of immigrants, where over 1 million refugees and migrants arrived in Europe per year. And this was met initially by a more, let's call it, open door attitude towards them, led by Germany and Sweden mostly. But then public opinion also shifted more, and there were more and more border controls, and it was ever harder for refugees to arrive in Europe, but also in the destination countries they were heading for. And the refugee crisis then was basically ended by the EU-Turkey deal in 2016, where the EU crafted this deal that Turkey, in return for huge financial aid, would hold refugees back, essentially. And I really wanted to talk about how politicians behaved in this crisis, how they communicated. And I thought it's most interesting to look at the two extremes, Angela Merkel and Viktor Orban. Angela Merkel being the former chancellor of Germany, who took this welcoming stance, and Viktor Orban being still the prime minister of Hungary, who was very much rejecting this attitude of welcoming refugees from the start. And I want to start off by him, because he framed this crisis in a threatening way. He coined refugees as economic migrants who are essentially trying to abuse the Hungarian welfare system and take away Hungarian jobs. He created this image of a zero-sum game where whatever refugees, or how he would say migrants, achieve, everything they get is at the expense of natives, of like everything they get is lost to the real Hungarians. And he tried to dehumanize refugees also by avoiding the very term refugees and only sticking to the term of migrants. We will also, I think, see this pattern of avoiding certain terminology in NGOs, in media. So this is an overarching strategy. And it can be used for different purposes. Orban clearly used it to dehumanize refugees and to suppress this moral connotation that comes with refugees, that they deserve help. When you just call them migrants, which is a term that you don't associate that much suffering with, for example. And what he also did is that he addressed the European audience beyond Hungary. He wanted to make him seen as the representative of anti-immigration, of the anti-immigration stance. And he externalized the guilt and responsibility of the crisis and all the challenges that European countries were facing onto Germany. And he stated that there is a conspiracy behind the vast movements of people. So actually that there must be something more. It's so many people. It can't just be this tiny civil war, these endurable hardships in their countries. But there is a conspiracy behind that. And this, of course, helps him to make himself be seen as the man, the leader that fights the threat, which are the refugees. And he will protect his community from it. So also in contrast to Merkel, he doesn't appeal to his country, to his people, in a way that he tries to nurture this us, like this we will make it, what Merkel always tried to promote. But he says, I'm the man who's going to save us from this crisis. And of course, this is something that can be very effective, because if you trust this man, that's a good, that's an easy solution. You think he has the means, he has the tools to do so. And Merkel, however, more like she moralized this situation and at the same time rationalized it. She always used this phrase, we will make it. But also she added, initially when she said, which is, I think, maybe even more important, we will make it, and wherever there is something in our way, we must overcome it. So she, there is a moral connotation about it, that not helping refugees is not even an option. We are morally obliged to do so, and it will be manageable because we must. There's no other way, and Germany is capable of doing so. And this shows that America didn't really have a plan. Like, nobody had a plan. And I think in most crisis politicians, those who have the power don't have a plan during the crisis or when the, like, when the shit is really burning. Nobody has a plan. But it is important, and this is what she tried, to convey an attitude that makes her trustworthy, that makes people trust her with dealing with it, and also makes the German society trust in itself that they can make it. This is a huge difference to Orban. And she, in contrast to him, always used the term refugees, and she never spoke of migrants, sometimes of asylum seekers. I think this is also something that she has in common with most NGOs. And she also rather humanized refugees. Shortly after the whole situation peaked in late summer, fall of 2015, she went to a first arrival refugee accommodation and took photos with the refugees, talked to them, showed proximity, and showed that they are people like us. They are approachable, and we will approach them. So she doesn't, create this picture of the threat out there embodied by the refugees, but that the refugees are actually the victims of a threat, and we as a community have the duty to help them. I'm curious about how NGOs approach this whole situation. I would think they're closer to Merkel than to Orban, but Ale, I think you know this far better than I do.
Yeah, so. Thank you, Jesper, so much. I think it was very important for you to paint a bit the landscape for us and for us to understand that it was just not only a humanitarian emergency, but it was also a battleground where competing narratives like Orban's and Merkel's were happening at the same time. And in this moment where populist groups were amplifying fears, tying refugees to terrorism or crime, NGOs were trying to humanize the crisis, were trying to urge governments to do something, and of course engage the public and make them spark at least some empathy towards what was happening. So I will talk a bit about how in this very polarized context, NGOs were really forced to become storytellers and use traditional and social media as these crucial platforms to show what was happening on the ground, at the same time try to document human rights violations from the EU, and also combat these populist narratives. First, I will start with traditional media strategies. So NGOs really relied on information subsidies, which are like press releases, news stories, and expert interviews, which facilitate media reporting. This provides media outlets, easy ways to understand the information that these NGOs are gathering, and it is information easily accessible to journalists so that they can better paint the picture in their outlets as well. I think this is one of the critical components of the advocacy strategies that NGOs were using at the time. And thanks to a research by Young and Safer, I really recommend to everyone to look into a paper, NGOs Advocacy in the 2015 Refugee Crisis, a study of agenda building in the digital age. I think they really try to compare to see which NGOs were thriving in the traditional media and which NGOs were thriving in social media. So one key takeaway was that traditional media was thriving on accessible and reliable sources. So NGOs that presented well-documented narratives and expert opinions were the ones who were able to dominate the headlines. For example, you can think about organizations like Doctors Without Borders or the International Rescue Committee, which were the ones who were gaining significant media presence due to their well-documented narratives and their very well-established position. However, traditional media, although it was favoring destructional material, it also had its limitations in engaging particularly audiences in the fast-paced social media environment. So in terms of the social media, those who were thriving were more like specialist NGOs who were focusing on refugee issues, as they were the ones who, for example, had interconnected networks, and also those who were trying to engage their followers through likes, shares, and comments, particularly those, for example, documenting human rights abuses. For them, it was very important that people were sharing this content and that this was being spread out. And I think something that was the main thing that helped NGOs build trust and become trusted sources was this part of stakeholder engagement, so that people, including their followers, donors, but also volunteers, to engage with the content that NGOs were presenting on social media. And I think that something that you also mentioned and that is very important is this part of which tools were they using. So one of them was statistics. Statistics and numbers were playing a crucial role. For example, using numbers about the daily death tolls of what was happening in the Mediterranean. NGOs really relied hard on very hard statistics that were shocking to communicate the gravity of the crisis, and also to, in some way, critique what the EU was doing at the time. These figures were just not informative, but they were also designed to provoke this sense of urgency among the policymakers and the public. But something that they would do is not just only have statistics, but also pair them with visuals to bridge like an emotional gap when statistics alone can feel very abstract and like just numbers. So they would use, for example, pictures of overcrowded boats, families stranded at borders, and refugee camps under really harsh conditions, which brought the crisis into this sharp, more personal focus, I would say. And as we know, and probably was the same case with traditional forms of media and newspapers, a lot of the focus was a lot in children or women, as these are people who are easier to empathize with, I would say, for a lot of people. But it's interesting that in NGOs, the visual storytelling wasn't just limited to hardship. It also extended to, for example, protests and demonstrations from the people in EU states, and they were reinforcing this political dimension of the crisis and highlighting that public solidarity was very necessary to have with those on the move. I think something very interesting was the UNHCR case, where they were primarily representing forcibly displaced people in its press releases and news as victimized and or voiceless masses. However, stories, photos, and videos usually portrayed these forcibly displaced people as empowered individuals. besides statistics and pictures, I think something that we're using a lot, the NGOs, were human stories, so individual testimonies, for example, and the stories of children crossing the borders, or of parents seeking safety, which were personalizing the crisis, and of course also the testimonies recording human rights abuses and pushbacks. And one very important part is this politics of terminology, I would say. The main terminology that NGOs were using were people on the move, refugees, asylum seekers, and the terminology that they would almost never use or really avoid it was illegal migrants, flood or swarms of migrants, invasion, illegal aliens, even refugee crisis, and I would say invasion. They were really trying to not reinforce these narratives, and they were trying to denounce a lot human rights violations. And for example, the concept Fortress Europe really came out, where they were trying to show what the responsibility of the EU border policies were, and that there was some European accountability of what was happening, no? I think my last point would be that usually in specifically the websites and reports, more than in social media, NGOs were really pairing all of their critiques, stories, etc., with clear recommendations. So it was not only these dark critiques or these dark stories, but also what can the EU do better. For example, they were advocating for safe passage for asylum seekers, equitable resettlement quotas, and or legal protections for refugees, to just to mention a few. But I think that was really important in also positioning the NGOs as well trusted sources that also can provide some level of information about how to deal with this. But yeah, I don't know if you want to tell us about the media and the newspaper, Ceci. I think I touched a bit upon it and the role that NGOs had with them also.
Yeah, yeah. The newspapers and media did not give the recommendations as the NGOs did, but the phrasing and framing what you were talking about is exactly also related to this topic, because I think it's good to maybe look at the overall general media framing of the refugees themselves. Often they were very stereotypically portrayed, so the media depicted them as in a very binary frame, as deserving or undeserving migrants. So for example, a deserving were children, undeserving were these young male adults. They were often seen as economic migrants, so these narrative shaped refugees as either a vulnerable or a dangerous outsider group, which then of course contributed to this polarized public opinion. And also how they were phrasing it, what words they were using, as you already said, Ale, especially, for example, if you take the Daily Mail, I found studies about it that it often referred to migrants or refugees as a swarm, but then temporarily shifted to a more more humane term after a famous picture came out. I will talk about it in a second. But yeah, so you can really see this difference between humanization and dehumanization of the refugees themselves, the dehumanizing way of, for example, having pictures of large faceless crowds, as you said already. But then there are also a lot of humanizing stories. For example, the humans of New York's the Syrian Americans. You can look into it. I can really recommend it. It's a nice reportage, making these human stories very visible. But then not only talking about the words they use, but the images. One image I already now mentioned is the image of Alan Kurdi. Alan Kurdi was or is a drowned Syrian boy who was washed onto the shore of Turkey and became very famous in September the 2nd, actually, in 2015, because his photo was shared over 20 million times in 12 hours. It raised a lot of public sympathy, and suddenly there was a brief shift in the narratives you could see all across Europe. Newspapers, for example, like Bild, who is normally not that known to be friendly to migrants in what they're reporting on, removed all images of their front page to emphasize the tragedy tragedy, yeah, of refugees, sorry. But yeah, it's really, it was a difficulty covering it because you at one hand have this victimized imagery to raise compassion for people, but at the same time, you pair it with language that reinforces these fears, waves, floods, and something. It was really, it came down to these editorial choices to not emotionally manipulate the public, but at the same time report on it and maybe raise compassion for the refugees themselves. I have a study I can recommend, Journalistic Practices in the Representation of Europe's 2014 to 2016 Migrant and Refugee Crisis, which looks into the different ways of reporting in Europe. And it's actually interesting because it finds a difference in the media coverage across countries, so Western Europe versus Eastern Europe. It takes as an example, in Germany, for example, Der Spiegel, which covered the refugee stories very empathetically, using personal profiles to highlight the family's realities of fleeing the war. But then also in France, Le Monde, that tried to balance their reporting with compassion, but at the same time give political critique to EU inaction. So it showcased really much this way of humanity and systematic failures and reporting on it. And then if you take Eastern European outlets, they, for example, avoided such pictures as Ellen Kurdi's because they were focusing instead on border security and the refugee influx itself, framing it as a threat to the security, which was very interesting that there was this divide between West and East. And at the same time, the study also highlighted that there was a difference between hosting countries and non-hosting countries, how they reported on it, and the type of newspaper. So there was a report of the Council of Europe, which reported on the EU, the UK tabloids as the Daily Mail, that often leaned into a sensational way of how to report on it, while Scandinavian and German outlets provided a more balanced and contextualized coverage, depending on which newspaper it is, if it's just a newspaper for free. But yeah, it brings a lot of ethical dilemmas for the journalists themselves. They also need to deal with something, a crisis that can take an emotional toll on them. And it's not very easy, especially if you look at the picture of Ellen Kurdi. Many newspapers were arguing, for example, The Guardian decided to show it because it argued that it helped to show the human cost of the war, while the BBC, for example, chose not show it because of the emotional manipulation. So it's really comes down to, what do we want to communicate? How can we not influence the public too much? Yeah, I think you already mentioned social media out of an NGO a perspective. I think it's important to maybe look at it also in general, that it could have, it was definitely an amplification of narratives, but at the same time, it also had a dividing role because it had these voices for empathy, but at the same time, it was also very xenophobic. For example, the clickbait headlines that were fueling the rhetoric. And at the same time, there was a lot of citizen journalism going on, so everybody could just text and write whatever they thought was true. But then towards the end of the crisis, you could already see that everybody was getting numb to the news because this constant exposure led to the public being very disengaged with the whole crisis. And it's very interesting also in the media coverage, you could see a shift that, for example, with the EU-Turkey agreement you mentioned in the beginning, Jesper, the narrative really only focused on the political deals and not really on the realities of the refugees themselves, which I found interesting that there was a difference.
Yeah, maybe just to wrap up quickly the episode of today, I think through our analysis of the crisis communication in the so-called 2015 refugee crisis, I think we looked specifically at politicians, international organizations and NGOs, and traditional media and newspapers. We try to understand more crisis communication, and the key things that came out were terminologies. So which terms do you choose to use, and then which narrative are you creating also in hand with this terminology? And I think one part of it is also the visual images that you're choosing to complement this narrative that you're creating. And finally, of course, the outlet. So if you were doing it through press statements, social media, just a text. Like, it really varied, but we can really see that crisis communication happens almost everywhere, and that it can vary very much, but it has these specific strategies that helps complement this narrative. Thank you so much, guys, for your perspectives. Yeah. And we hope to have you all listen to us next week.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
Bye.